From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Comedian and Hollywood icon Bob Hope died yesterday in Toluca Lake, California. His career spanned the decades and crossed from vaudeville to radio to television and film. But Bob Hope may be remembered most fondly for entertaining combat troops in four consecutive wars.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Here we are in Incirlik, Turkey. Incirlik, that's a Turkish word meaning don't knock it. It beats Vietnam. Well, this is a great country. This is the land of belly dancers. Belly dancers, that's Turkish naval maneuvers. I visited the mosque when I was here 6 years ago, and this trip I plan to visit them again. I'm not overly religious. I just want to get my shoes back. Yes, I'm thrilled to be here in Berlin, one of our most famous snow jobs. We flew in through the air corridor. At least it's plainly marked. You just stay between the tracer bullets. The corridor is a narrow strip through East Germany, policed on both sides by Russian MiGs. I don't know how many there were. It's hard to see from under the seat. This is our fifth triumphant year in Lackey. You can tell the lizards salute back. No, Lackey is one of my favorite swamps. And these men have a tremendous mission stationed here in the middle of this huge rubber plantation, guarding next year's supply of bras and girdles.
And he certainly kept them coming. Tonight on Point, Bob Hope, America's wisecracking MC, dead at 100. We begin with Bob Thompson, On Point media critic. He's professor of media and popular culture at Syracuse University. I asked him what Bob Hope brought to entertainment during his long career.
Well, what's so interesting about seven decades is if you spend seven decades back in the 1600s, it wouldn't be a big deal. Things didn't change that much. What he did in spanning seven decades of the seven decades he did essentially means this guy got to be there and be present during vaudeville, during radio, during the movies, and during television. He really becomes the only person that reached almost a superstar level all across the board on all of those media. So if nothing else, if there's nothing else we remember him for, he's an interesting science experiment. He's a control guy who did all four of the things in one lifetime.
And in which of those media did he make the most impact, would you say?
I would say if you had to assign his biggest stardom to one medium, it would have to be radio. What he did, especially during World War II on the radio, really was coming into the most intimate domestic spaces of American homes during some really kind of emotional and trying times. And that linkage of entertainment and patriotism that Bob Hope so expertly effected really was an important part of the home front culture at the time. So I would say by far radio was his most important medium.
And as an entertainer of the troops?
He did, of course, live entertainment, not just in vaudeville, but entertaining troops in World War II, in Vietnam, and continued thereafter as well. We only got to know about that, of course, through the television specials that played later. What's especially interesting about Bob Hope is that the actual material he left, and I don't mean to be disrespectful to him, but it isn't classic. I don't think we would put any of his movies on a list of the top 200 best American films. If you go back and actually listen to his radio stuff, it was beloved at the time, but it doesn't match up with people like Jack Benny and Burns and Allen and those types. And he didn't do any real classic television either. It's almost as though his celebrity, what he stood for, and the kind of constant presence of this figure transcended the actual material he's left. Kids know about him not because they watch his movies or see reruns of his television shows. They know about him because he is talked about so affectionately by their parents, their grandparents, and their great-grandparents.
So what was Bob Hope's talent then? He once said of himself, "The only thing I have is timing and lots of experience."
I think probably his greatest talent that got him as far as he did is he had a pretty good act and he was a real likable character. And likability in American media took you a long way, especially as we moved into the era of radio and television. he was a pleasant guy to watch. He fell in that category of people like Johnny Carson and Bill Cosby, who I think is the only contemporary guy who even stands the comparison to Bob Hope.
Now, I think it's probably true to say that for most of the under 40s, Bob Hope was a comedian of an era gone by. What kind of influence, if any, do you think he had on the counterculture comedians that came after him?
If Bob Hope had much of an influence on the contemporary batch of comedians, it was as the type of comedian they, in fact, make fun of in many ways. The kind of set-up punchline, the almost rimshot sort of humor that Bob Hope did. It is humor from a different era. One would be kind of hard-pressed, I think, if they had to sit through radio show after radio show from the 40s and 50s of Bob Hope. We just don't tell jokes like that anymore. However, back then that was how we told jokes. People liked it. But one of the reasons that younger people don't hear him is that comedy has so drastically changed since his heyday on a very fundamental structural level. We don't even tell a joke anywhere near the same anymore, as Bob Hope was so good at telling one.
And those jokes, a lot of the times topical, sometimes saucy, but never dirty.
Right. You couldn't, of course, get away with the kind of dirty humor that you can now, because there was no place to do it. There would have been a few live venues, but you'd have certainly never been able to do it on radio and television. For his time, though, he went pretty blue compared to what else was on there. He was a pretty out-there kind of guy. His equivalent today would be some of these people that are doing stuff on HBO with the full language content and all the rest of it. So he was pushing envelopes at his time. Of course, he seems positively quaint and old-fashioned today.
And always pretty upbeat.
Right. I mean, in the end, he represented this optimism. I mean, the American century, the 20th century, once we got through the Depression and World War II, it just looked like the whole thing was going to be about as close to heaven as one could get. He spans those optimistic decades of the 50s and into the 1960s, even though we're in the middle of a Cold War, air conditioning in the home, new refrigerators, toys like you wouldn't believe, that delightful period of American optimism that he really managed to express and had really begun to fade a bit in his act by the time that whole dream began to go south.
Bob Thompson, many thanks.
My thanks to you.
And that was Bob Thompson, On Point media critic and professor of media and popular culture at Syracuse University. He spoke to us from New York. His mastery of the comic monologue and topical wisecracks made him an American superstar on Broadway, radio, films and television. Not bad for a working-class lad from Eltham, England. Leslie Towns Hope emigrated to the US and started his comedy career on the vaudeville stage behind Siamese twins and singing contortionists. He's legendary for entertaining US troops from World War II through the Persian Gulf War, always delivering laughs and a taste of home in the battle zones. From the Azores to wartime China, Bob Hope delivered bright one-liners and posed like Johnny Walker on a golf club with a series of Favour of the Month gal pals. What did Bob Hope mean to you? Why did you find him funny? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from San Francisco is Gerald Nachman. He's an entertainment writer and critic and author of Seriously Funny, The Rebel Comedians of the 1950s and 1960s. Also with us from Madison, Wisconsin is Sam Brolowski, curator of the Bob Hope and American Variety exhibition at the Library of Congress. Thank you both, gentlemen, for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Sam Brolowski, President Bush said of Bob Hope today, America has lost a great citizen. Few would disagree.
Absolutely. He was America's comedian. I think he thought of himself that way, and I think up until rather recently, you know, with the exception of those who weren't exposed to his entertainment, the country felt that way.
And what was his humor? Was it a very American type of humor?
Well, I'm not an expert on humor, but I think in many ways it was. He was brash, yet he was the guy next door. He very much cultivated that image of the guy next door, even going so far as to changing his name from Leslie to Bob, or Leslie to Lester to Bob. And he had a sort of a self-deprecating feature to his humor, in which he made fun of himself. He was the butt of his own humor often. He You know, he was brash, yet he was a coward. And, of course, most importantly, his humor from the late 30s on was topical. It was based on the headlines of the day.
Joe Luckman, we heard there from Sam Brulowski a few of the highlights of Bob Hope's style. Is there a way in which he was a pioneer of certain types of humor, certain types of comedy?
Well, I think he was one of the first conversational comics. He came out, he told one-liners, yes, but it was all wrapped up into a larger monologue, a routine. I think he defined what a comedian is, at least in America, and he exuded humor. The way he told jokes, the construction of the lines were very, very distinctive. The rhythms, just listening to the excerpts you played a few minutes ago, I was made aware of that. There's a certain tossed-off quality. There's very little fat on the lines. Every phrase counts. He was a very efficient comic in terms of, you know, jokes per, laughs per line.
Stay with us because Ali is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. And Ali, you say that Bob Hope's humor has had world impact, that his influence extended beyond the United States.
Absolutely. Good to have you in Boston, Julian, actually. And I know for a fact that movies from the 50s and the 40s is still played in Middle East area. And one-liners still work very well in those areas.
So what was his appeal? Was it the one-liners? Was it the timing? Was it the fact that people were being exposed to a very American way of life?
I actually think it was lack of crass joke. I think that's what got it through the channels to still be shown through TV. And the authorities not having problem, but at least giving a little bit of happiness and smile on people's faces without really touching too many subjects of the day.
Ali, many thanks for those comments. Gerald Nachman, Bob Hope always played it pretty straight, but he could also be quite risque.
Yeah, I think he was kind of the Howard Stern of his day, although the standards were quite a bit different. He got away with a lot of double entendres, and by today's standards, very tame, of course. But I remember when I was a kid going to high school, after his show, I think it was on a Tuesday, his radio show on Tuesday nights, you'd always hear about all the lines that got cut off the air, and so he had that kind of risque persona, the bravado. He was always leering at girls. Not in a dirty way, just kind of a wholesome all-American way. He was very much, as someone else has said earlier, a very American type. The breezy wise guy, the braggart, the con man, all those things. And he was also, didn't look like a comedian. He looked like a regular guy. He didn't look like Groucho Marx or Red Skelton or Milton Berle or Jerry Lewis. He was not a clown. He was, you know, a guy you might meet. He was like a traveling salesman in a certain way.
Sam Brulowski, very much an American comedian, Bob Hope. But why did he identify, do you think, so closely with the different administrations of the day?
You know, the easy answer, and I think it's the correct one, is, you know, it was a key to success for him. He liked being in the limelight. He liked traveling in those circles. He wanted to be topical and he wanted to be pointed, but he also wanted to be in the circle of both Republicans and Democrats, conservatives and liberals.
Sam Brulowski, Gerald Nachman, do stay with us. We're talking tonight about the life, laughs and legacy of Bob Hope, who died yesterday at 100. What did Bob Hope mean to you? Did his comedy speak to you, or was it a throwback to another generation? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about comedian and Hollywood icon Bob Hope, who died yesterday at 100 years of age. One of Bob Hope's most popular roles was as the quaking coward in a series of road movies opposite Bing Crosby. Here's The Road to Morocco.
Hey, those guys, those were Mully Kassam's gorillas.
Yeah, and that joint must be their hideout, huh? Well, we gotta save the girls. It's up to us now, Turkey. We'll have to storm the place.
You storm. I'll stay here and drizzle.
I got something that can't miss.
So have they, guns.
Now look, now listen to every word, see? We don't have to wait for night, see? We just go up on the place and we get the thing complete.
Do you think you know we're here?
We're still wearing our heads, aren't we?
That was the dopiest idea I ever heard. You thinking you could skin a horse and put me inside. How would I look being a horse?
Just the same. Look, we gotta get back to where we started from and wait till dark. Let's go.
Okay.
So did Bob Hope's comedies speak to you, or was it a throwback from another generation? Did you miss his presence in the latest Gulf War? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking to Gerald Nachman, entertainment writer and critic, author of Seriously Funny, The Rebel Comedians of the 1950s and 60s, and Sam Brilowski, curator of the Bob Hope and American Variety exhibit at the Library of Congress. Sam Brilowski, Bob Hope had this all-American image, but it didn't start out that way. Can you just tell us a little bit about his childhood?
Well, Hope was, like a lot of his vaudeville contemporaries, an immigrant to the United States. He was born in outside of London, and he came here to the United States. His family settled in Cleveland a little before his fourth birthday. And he was a ruffian, hung out with boys from the neighborhood, wasn't too successful in school, had just a large number of jobs before he went into show business, newspaper vendor, pool hustler, street corner singer, worked for a car salesman, and was a boxer for a short period of time, and then took dancing lessons from a local African-American dancer, King Rastus was his name, and began in vaudeville as a dancer.
So the early life was quite a struggle for Bob Hope. Do you think that shaped his view of the world thereafter?
Well, yeah, I don't know how rough it was. I mean, his father wasn't particularly successful. His mother seemed to have been the rock in the family. But it was, I guess I would call it a working-class family. It wasn't a broken home or anything like that. But I'm sure it shaped his view. And that one thing I think of when I think of Bob Hope is an enormously hard worker, an ambitious man, a man who was just always driven, always working. And I can't help but to feel that was affected by his life on the streets as a young boy.
Joel Nachman, do you see that early life showing itself at all in his humor, in his comedy?
Well, I guess he learned to be something of a hustler. I don't mean that in a negative way. He just had to work hard, as you said, and he had to hustle various odd jobs until he found the thing that he was best at. And I guess he kind of fell into that. It doesn't sound like he started out to be in show business like a lot of comedians or performers. He just found that he could do it, I guess, and after he took dancing lessons. And he was able to, he had a real work ethic, as Sam just said. He never gave, he was one of those performers of that era whose whole life was on stage. We never knew what the real Bob Hope was like. He was a performer 24 hours a day, a comic as far as we know. Of course, he had an interior life, but nobody ever was able to crack it. He presented one image to the world, and because he found what he could do, and he found an image that worked and succeeded, and he was a very successful businessman. Larry Gelbart, who I talked to for the earlier book I did called Raised on Radio, said that he was even smarter and wittier off stage or off mic than he was on, and I think one of his head writer said he could have been the CEO of General Electric. He was a very sharp guy and a very organized and focused guy, which he had to be if you were going to make it in vaudeville and transfer over into all the various mediums that he did.
Well, let's take a call now from William in Newport, Rhode Island. Hello, William.
Hi, how are you?
And what would you like to say?
I just wanted to say I have a few different opinions about Bob Hope, who I enjoyed very much over the whole lifetime of him being on the air anywhere. I thought he showed us the funny side of sarcasm and our own suffering. He gave us a way to glad suffer it. And we needed that on occasion because we're all wrapped up in all these other things in life and the domestic things we do and the work ethic and everything else. And we all have that suffering aspect. And he relieved it for us, and he did a good job. And I do think, though, that he did look like a clown. I think that was one of his witticisms, his psychology. Because of the way he looked, I think he became wisdom.
So he brightened up your life, did he, William?
Well, I mean, he brightened up everyone's life. You couldn't help it because his approach of sarcasm was very funny. He does it more like the English do it rather than the normal American comic.
Gerald Nachman, that's an interesting point there that William was making. He's suggesting a somewhat English style to Bob Hope's humor.
That never occurred to me. He wasn't broad. He was certainly more sophisticated than a lot of comedians of his day in vaudeville. And his idol was a guy named Frank Fay, who's not remembered very much anymore, who was a very breezy monologist who just stood on stage. I never have seen him, but I've read a lot about him. And he also influenced Jack Benny. A lot of the more laid-back style of comedians studied Frank Fay, who just stood up in a very conversational manner, reeled off some, you know, funny lines. And I think that influenced him a lot. And Fay was American, but I think that's more of a British style.
But the self-deprecation, again, that strikes me as being quite British, but counterposed with the brashness of Bob Hope. There was a sort of an internal...
Well, the brashness was in the movies, really, more than on stage, I think. And that was... the little excerpt you played before of Crosby and Hope was interesting because I think they weren't really a comedy team per se. They fell into it by being in the road movies. But they worked so well together because Crosby was very cool and laid back, and Hope was a little more frenetic in the films. And I think that's why they worked so well in movies.
Let's just hear now from Steve. He's calling from Boston, and he's an amateur comic. Is that right, Steve?
Yes, that's correct. I'm now in Newton, so I drove from Boston to Newton. But yes, I'm more of a salesman than a comedian, given the climate out there for comedians. But in the many years that I had done stand-up, what I always liked about seeing Bob Hope in action was he was timeless. He was able to transcend numerous generations, and he never got bitter or angry. I just think of Carlin, who's one of my idols too, but he's devolved into this angry, vituperative sort of guy who's just—it's his act rings hollow when you think about the trappings he's obtained in wealth and fame. And, I think Hope was a guy who just was great at mirroring his audience and mirroring his situation, very much in a conversationalist way, like your guests had mentioned earlier.
Sam Brulowski, how did Bob Hope live with the fame and the trappings of wealth?
Well, I think he enjoyed it. I think Bob Hope liked being in the limelight. He's very well known not only for his work on behalf of armed forces, but all of his charity benefits, all the dinners he did. I think he saw that as a way to give something back, which is what he claimed his mother taught him he should do, but also as a way to keep in the forefront. On the other hand, as Gerald Nachman stated, he was a private individual, and he had, he probably loved nothing more than to being on a golf course and playing golf with golfers, not other comedians trying to top each other with jokes.
But he enjoyed rubbing shoulders with the rich and powerful.
Absolutely.
And why was that, do you think?
Well, I mean, in part, maybe because he came up from the working class. He enjoyed the stature that he attained. I think he liked being Bob Hope. He was, I think from probably the late 40s and early 50s on, he'd achieved an iconic stature in American entertainment and in the United States, and he liked being looked up to and coming into town with the fans and doing these one-night stands either for charity or for just as a comedy gig, and enjoyed that acclaim like so many entertainers do.
Let's go to Gerald.
No, I was just going to say he never apologized for being Bob Hope. He was what they call comfortable in his own skin. I think he enjoyed the wealth, he enjoyed the status, he enjoyed golfing with presidents, and yet he somehow through all that he kept that sort of regular guy persona that people responded to.
Okay, let's bring in Jalil. He's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Jalil, thanks for being with us. You're Iranian. What was the appeal of Bob Hope to you?
Well, first of all, Julian, let me welcome you to Colony again. That was one of Bob Hope's jokes. I thought I could use it on you. Because I met Bob Hope back in 1988. I was working in one of these stations. He was promoting his book. Believe it or not, I met him in the men's room. And so he just accidentally happened to walk there, and he was there talking to somebody else. So I introduced myself, and so that's what he told me. He said, how long have you been in the colony? So what happens, though, I think Bob Hope, to me, is more of an international comedian than just an American. Because anybody who barely understand or learned English, they could have understand him. I remember when it was during the hostage crisis, there was a big audience in Washington on one of the very winter cold Washington, and President Carter was in the audience. And he went on the stage, he says, boy, Iranian thinks they the one who have frozen assets. Look at this hall, it's frozen, it's cold, you know. Then he went on to say, he said, you know, President Carter doesn't believe foreign affairs. He thinks that if we're going to have an affair, we should have it inside.
Jalil, many thanks for that. Let's just bring in Guy. He's calling from Fond du Lac in Wisconsin. Guy, what did you want to say?
Well, I think the technical craft that Bob displayed is well displayed by the callers you had, but I think his greatest gift was I had the chance to see Bob in Vietnam. And I think the greatest gift he had to give was he showed us how to laugh at ourselves. He could take the worst of situations and just show how absurd it was that we were in this thing and turn it around and see the humor in this. It was just it was a gift he had for taking ordinary things and just make us laugh at how ridiculous some of it was. And I really do believe that was his greatest gift to us, just to be able to look at us in the mirror and say, boy, this is really dumb, and just laugh at it.
Joe Luckman, would you agree there with Guy that Bob Hope had this ability to hold up the mirror to America?
Well, I think so. As other people have said, he played off the headlines. He was very topical and somewhat political, although the jokes were really not that scathing. He would use presidents as kind of reference points, but they could be jokes about anyone. And he did like to make jokes about Eisenhower's golf and, you know, the usual things. I think he solidified himself as a particularly a good guy and American by those endless tours of army camps and military bases around the world. You know, a lot of performers did that, though, although for some reason we only think of him. And because he would do the broadcast from there as well, so that's how we got to know about it. And he did parlay that into part of his image.
Gerald Nachman, were you very conscious of Bob Hope at the time, molding that connection with the U.S. military into his image?
Well, yes, the GIs were his greatest audience because he was one of them in a way. He was a red-blooded all-American guy, as we've said, and he liked girls and he wasn't afraid to make jokes about it and talk about it. And here were these guys sitting out there, you know, without women and thinking about their girlfriends and just girls generally, I guess, when you're with 7,000 guys. And so they really identify with him. And he was that kind of a little bit risque, as we said. And they dug that. They really did like that. And of course, he made a lot of jokes at the expense of the military as well. The brass, of course, and the food and all of that. So that's why they all, when they show those films of the guys out in the audience sitting on the desert or wherever, laughing at them, they are really breaking up because, first of all, it was a little taste of home, and also he told jokes that they really, you know, could identify with.
Sam Brulowski, that womanizer role was very much part of Bob Hope's shtick. Was it just a role, or was it a part of the real Bob Hope?
I don't know. I mean, you read a lot of rumors about Bob Hope. He's on the road. I certainly nothing that we cover in our exhibit at the Library of Congress. but he did reflect. I mean, I certainly agree with the caller and Gerald Nachman about, you know, reflecting the soldiers' lust and, you know, love of women and you know, all of their attitudes. He liked to. You know, he liked to, you know, pinprick or you know, that sort of pretension of, you know, whether a pretentious American or, as you say, the military brass, and offered sort of inside information, I think, to the audiences about life in the military and about life in the United States to the military, sort of like an interlocutor. He would make fun of miniskirts, tell the boys about the miniskirts back home, and then tell back home about what the soldiers might be facing in Vietnam.
So Gerald Nachman, he was capable then of being gently subversive.
Exactly. Yeah, he was known to be something of a womanizer. That's not any secret, and it's maybe a little subversive to say it on the day after he died, but everyone knew it. And that, in an interesting way, that kind of played into his image, whether it was true or not or to what degree it was true, I don't know. But it's been written about, you know, widely for years and years and years. And he had several affairs and, you know, and someone said that was one of the reasons he liked to go overseas so much. He can't get away from that, get out of the house. But He used that in a way, and it was, as I say, and the jokes, the lechery, kind of good-natured lechery, was all part of what Bob Hope was all about.
Gerald Nachman, do stay with us. Gerald Nachman, entertainment writer and critic, author of Seriously Funny, The Rebel Comedians in the 1950s and 60s. Also, Sam Brulowski, curator of the Bob Hope and American Variety exhibit at the Library of Congress. We're discussing the lives, laughs, and legacy of Bob Hope, who died yesterday at 100 years of age. What did Bob Hope mean to you? Why did you find him funny? Did his brand of humor speak to you, or was it something from a bygone era? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about Bob Hope, comedian and American icon, who passed away yesterday at 100 years of age. Beloved by many for his devotion to the combat troops through four consecutive wars, what did Bob Hope mean to you? Why did you find him funny? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Well, there's no question about his success as a performer, but behind the smile was a complex and at times controversial figure. Not everyone shared the rosy perception of a happy-go-lucky Bob Hope. John Lahr is senior drama critic for The New Yorker magazine. His father, Broadway great Bert Lahr, most known for his role as the Cowardly Lion in The Wizard of Oz, was Hope's contemporary. John Lahr's 1998 expose on Bob Hope for The New Yorker was entitled The CEO of Comedy. I asked him what he meant by that title.
He franchised his personality, essentially. His writers have told me that they were looking for a personality that could be presented to the American public every week, and they decided really to take Hope's dominating aspects of his personality, his womanizing, his cheapness, his greed. They called him Piggy because he always wanted more of everything, more jokes, etc. He used to stand at the balcony and take their checks, make them into paper airplanes, and throw them down to them and make them jump for them. And he joked, that's the only exercise they ever got. Whereas most really great comedians think against the culture and have problems with management, Hope was unusual in the sense that he sort of joined management. In his radio broadcasts, he was always Bob, Pepsodent, Lever Brothers, whatever the advertiser, Hope. You know, he always joined his name with the product, just as he joined presidents and corporations. If you were to go into his house, as I did, what was interesting is, unlike most Hollywood stars' houses, the people that are in Hope's house are presidents and heads of corporations. He was into sort of that kind of mainstream power.
And are you suggesting that there was a lack of spontaneity, originality about him?
Well, I mean, I don't think of him really as a comic spirit. I mean, he himself called comedy a scam. When he made his first hit in the Rudy Valley Hour in 1928, he went around the corner and counted his money. And in a way, that's the character that you see in the movies. He had that larcenous quality. I'm not suggesting that he didn't have a comic energy, but what he caught, and I think this is important for when he caught the wave of his celebrity that he rode for so long, was he was not like the first generation of American immigrants, the first generation of the clowns, like my father or Chaplin or Keaton.
He'd basically embraced the country of his adoption.
Yeah, and there was something very slick. He was all future. He wasn't about the past. All the jokes which were recently given to the Library of Congress in the Bob Hope collection, I mean, this is the dilemma. They're Bob Hope's jokes because he paid for them, but he didn't write them. They were written to serve him. And I think that that is the dilemma. Ultimately, he was a businessman, and that's fine. But the purpose of comedy really is to debate the society and to take on and test boundaries and to question. And Hope never answered those priorities. In fact, his comedy was about escaping them rather than living up to them. And I think there is the area where I think theater historians like myself might debate him.
So he raised a laugh, but his jokes rarely raised ideas.
That's correct. They evaded ideas. What they did was they sniffed the hem of power and actually catered to it. He lent his joke writers to Nixon and Agnew to write jokes to put down and disparage the protests of the 60s and 70s, for which he never recovered in the terms of public popularity. He lost a whole constituency of fans that had been with him right through two decades. You know, he was anodyne. And especially in times of war, that's very in demand. You know, Hope was the most decorated civilian in American life, I think. And he served the country importantly in the Second World War and in Korea and came a cropper in Vietnam, as I say, because of his own right-wing convictions. And he lost his constituency for the next generation. Considering how important he was in his time, his jokes had always traded on being up to the minute, and he lost his sense of the minute.
John Law, many thanks.
My pleasure.
And that was John Law, senior drama critic for The New Yorker magazine. He spoke to us from London. And still with us, Gerald Nachman, entertainment writer and critic, author of Seriously Funny, The Rebel Comedians of the 1950s and 60s, and Sam Brolowski, curator of the Bob Hope and American Variety exhibit at the Library of Congress. Gerald Nachman, do any of those observations of Bob Hope by John Law strike a resonance with you?
Yeah, I can agree with all of it. I think he did have a comic spirit. I don't quite agree with that. And one of the men who wrote for him said the writers respected him because he could ad lib. He really could do it. I mean, he wasn't a writer, but like a lot of comedians, he had a great sense of what jokes worked for him. And I think John Law's right. He did not, as he says, debate society. He was not that kind of a comedian like later comedians who I talk about in my book in the 60s, like Mort Saul, who really did take on the establishment, and Lenny Bruce, and people like that, Mike Nichols and Elaine May, who made great fun of it. that wasn't his role. He did come from another era, and I think Mr. Lars said that he lost his constituency. I don't know if he did. He kind of polarized it, I would say, because there were plenty of people who were with him on the war, but there were also plenty of people, the children of the people that were for the war generally, who were against it. So that hurt him.
Well, Gerald, let's just hear from one of those, because I've got David calling from Medfield, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. David, what did you want to say?
Yes, I was one of those the children of the fans who I remember very distinctly. About half the audience at a commencement at Brown University in either the late 60s or early 70s turning their backs on Bob Hope, and in fact, he was given an honorary degree, and I'm pretty sure that in part he was given the honorary degree by the trustees as sort of a in-your-face gesture at the students. And he was very definitely a polarizing figure when it came to Vietnam. There was nothing gracious about him when it came to debate about that particular issue, and he was very definitely on the side of the establishment. So, I'm one of those people who whom he lost forever after that.
And Jeffrey, calling from Dallas, Texas, good day to you. You're a Vietnam veteran, and you hold a similarly reserved view, to put it mildly, about Bob Hope.
No, it's not a reserved view at all. His jingoistic patriotism was an insult to anybody who served in Vietnam. He was a very unthinking and uncaring human being who was a very rich man. I mean, he was in my opinion, a sort of nasty, uncaring sort who exploited his reputation for entertaining the troops to no good end. I mean, the fact is that when I was in Vietnam, which albeit was when most of the infantry troops were, you know, pretty much in mutiny, he was a joke. And if anybody, mentioned his name, I mean, he was a reviled figure. And I find his memory distasteful to this day.
Sam Brulowski, is that side of Bob Hope, that particular controversy surrounding his life, reflected in the exhibit at the Library of Congress?
Oh, yes, it is. There is a part of the exhibition which deals with his public service, and we have several artifacts which relate to the Vietnam era, some of him defending himself in but our captions for it, explain the controversy. And there was a very controversial show that Bob Hope put on in Washington called Honor America Day. And we have it there to reflect that era, which is not unlike this era, in which sometimes people who are against the war then or the war now are painted as unpatriotic. And I think that was in large part, the intent of so-called Honor America Day, where in the shadow of the Washington Monument, Bob Hope and Kate Smith were in effect staging a counter demonstration to those which were so common in Washington, D.C. at the time.
Gerald Nachman, should the personal and political views of a comedian matter, as they seem so much to have done to those callers?
Well, I think it does matter, of course. I think what happened also, along with his, politicizing the war by his being there, although he was only doing what he'd always done, which is go overseas and try to make people laugh. I mean, it's hard to knock that. I think what also happened at the same time is that his kind of humor became dated as well as perhaps his political views, and that got all mixed up together. I think the guys who were over in Vietnam were probably found his kind of humor, his kind of gags, a little bit dated, and I think that also is what hurt him, along with his stance on the war. But he wasn't an in-your-face kind of guy like, say, John Wayne, I don't think.
Right. Let me just bring back Sam Brulowski just very, very briefly. Just to end on an upbeat note, Sam, very, very briefly, how will he be remembered, do you think, Bob Hope?
Oh, I think he'll be remembered as someone who made fun of America, as someone who achieved great success in America. I think that, you know, unlike to disagree mildly with John Lahr, you know, the purpose of a comedian is to make us laugh, simplistically, and okay. He did so.
Sam Brelowski, curator of the Bob Hope and American Variety exhibit at the Library of Congress, many thanks to you for being with us. My thanks to you too, Gerald Nachman, entertainment writer and critic, author of Seriously Funny, The Rebel Comedians of the 1950s and 1960s.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Bob Hope is credited as the originator of the topical monologue. It was the attention-grabbing starter that distinguished the Pepsodent Hour, Hope's first success at radio in 1938. We leave you tonight with an example of the comic monologue, a form adopted by television stalwarts Sid Caesar, Jack Parr and David Letterman. This excerpt from the Bob Hope Show is a radio performance from April the 8th, 1947. Bob Hope, exhibiting the topical humor which made him famous, is talking about a telephone strike going on at the time.
I don't care whether I get laughs tonight or not. My sponsor can't call me tonight. Shouldn't use that kind of language anyway. But anyway, the phone strike has affected the contest for my favorite brunette. One listener sent in a jingle saying, "My favorite brunette, how I wish I could date her. She's my long-distance telephone operator." Didn't win a thing. It's going to be tough getting any messages through, too. I was out in my backyard this afternoon, heard one carrier pigeon say to another, "I don't know about you, Mabel, but I ain't strike-breaking." But I feel wonderful tonight. I've been down to Palm Springs. I have to come back. I ran out of cosigners. Palm Springs, that's an old Indian expression meaning pale face come and stay in sun to look like red man, him look at hotel bill and go home pale face. What prices for those rooms down there? For $50 a day, you get a room with a view of the mountains, and for $25 a day, you get one with a view of the desert. My room costs $5 a day. Every morning, the bellboy slipped a postcard of a cactus plant under my door. I stayed in a nice place in Palm Springs. You've heard of the Lone Palm? Well, all night, the dates kept dropping out of it and hitting me in the head. And in the morning, they'd all waken you by ringing your telephone. A bellboy tiptoes in, tickles your toes, and whispers, "It's later than you think." Yes, sir. Of course, I mingled with the 400 while I was there. In Palm Springs, they don't care how many they put in a room. It was a nice room, and the towels were all marked his, hers, and put them back. Everybody was there last week, and boy, that sun suit Dorothy L'Amour had on. She was sitting over there with a copy of Forever Amber in her hand, and the book was reading her. I couldn't get regular suntan oil, so I rubbed Texaco number 30 on my back. It was so embarrassing. A Chevrolet kept coming up and nuzzling me.
The voice of Bob Hope, master of the comic monologue. And that was an extract from the Bob Hope Show from April the 8th, 1947. Bob Hope died yesterday at the age of 100. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.